Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. There is a lot we need to be protecting our country against. It's a full employment program for us here at Securing America. One of the most important problems that is getting extremely inadequate attention is the wrecking operation that the Biden administration is engaged in across the broadest imaginable front. But most urgently and immediately, against the sovereignty of our country. This is a topic that we've addressed on a couple of programs recently, and I'm delighted to have with us a woman I work closely with in a number of different capacities. Her name is Dee Dee Laugesen. She is the executive secretary of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and the executive director of our Save the Persecuted Christians. And we're going to be talking about both of these portfolios of hers with her today. Dee Dee, it's so good to have you back on Securing America. Welcome.
Hi, Frank. Good to be with you.
Let me ask you first, Dee Dee, about this effort that the Biden administration has made, rather, I think it's fair to say, surreptitiously, in connection with an entity that I don't think any of us have ever heard of, called the World Health Assembly, which is supposed to be meeting in Geneva, Switzerland, a little less than 2 weeks from now, with the idea in mind of amending the treaty by which the World Health Organization interacts with member nations around the world. And all nations, I think, are members of the World Health Organization. Tell us about these amendments that have actually been proposed by the Biden administration. What would they do, and what would they mean for us?
Yeah, so at the very last minute in January, the United States put forth proposed amendments to what is known as the International Health Regulations. This is a treaty that was signed in 1969 and revised in 2005. The proposed amendments go against what the WHO working group wanted to do. They want to pass a new treaty for pandemic response. But the United States instead is moving to strengthen the international health regulations by giving WHO and its director, Dr. Tedros, power to unilaterally impose public health emergencies of international concern, or even to put in place intermediate public health emergencies, either internationally or regionally. These proposed amendments give power to the WHO to impose upon nation states, including the United States, lockdowns, vaccines, all measure of response mechanisms. And this pandemic response is no longer just to disease. Yes, mandates, passport mandates, all of these things are going to be within the purview of Dr. Tedros should we give over our sovereignty to the WHO with these amendments.
Let's just calibrate on the inadvisability of this for a minute, Dee Dee. Dr. Tedros was the guy who brought us the World Health Organization's response to the COVID-19 pandemic, the Chinese Communist Party virus-inspired pandemic. Talk a little bit about this guy. Talk a bit about his relationship to the Chinese Communist Party and how he performed the last time around.
So Dr. Tedros failed to hold the Chinese Communist Party to the international health regulations, which are being proposed to be amended. And Dr. Tedros was the spokesperson for the Chinese Communist Party in terms of protecting them and promoting their narrative with regards to the origins of the COVID virus. The Chinese Communist Party has an outsourced. Absolutely, they hid the information. They protected the Chinese Communist Party to the detriment of the health of the rest of the world.
Right. So, why one would want to repose in a person who has performed so abysmally more power of any kind, let alone power to make determinations as to what our health policies should be? And worse, Didi, and I want you to tease this out for us, health is in the eye of the beholder, apparently. These health emergencies that this gal by the name of Lois Pace, an assistant secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, an assistant secretary for the Department of Health and Human Services, with the global affairs portfolio there, has come up with these amendments, apparently, to the extent that, as you said, public health emergencies of international concern can be designated as such by Dr. Tedros at his whim, no accountability at all. Can he also define what constitutes a public health emergency that may have very little bearing on pandemics or even disease for that matter?
Right. So Lois Pace, an activist, a political activist and a community organizer, which is typical of the Biden administration to place in positions of power, submitted these proposals, which gives teeth to the international health regulations, allows compliance, allows sanctions against countries that are not complying. And it is obvious from what we know of the Biden administration and the various things that they've been talking about, they see climate, guns, hate speech, including possibly Christian conservatives, as potential threats to the public health. So we are seeing a broadening of powers to the international community through the UN that would be able to demand that the United States take care of its hate speech problems and its gun problems by the way that they determine we need to do it. So Lois Pace is the perfect person to be driving this.
Yeah. And if it bears a striking resemblance to the way the Chinese communists would take care of such problems, the China model, which I think Tedros was very substantially responsible for insinuating into both this country and a lot of others around the world, that would be rather inimical, shall we say, to our freedoms. And Didi, we're going to have to take a short break here. I want to ask you on the other side of it, just quickly to comment on what can be done in light of the fact that within less than a fortnight, less than 2 weeks, we're going to see the World Health Assembly voting on Lois Pace's amendments. And all other things being equal at the moment, it seems likely endorsing them and creating thereby this huge diminution of our sovereignty and its accretion to a very dubious character working for the Chinese Communist Party, essentially the people who put him in that position. Over the next 5 years, he just got a new term of office. These are the sorts of things we desperately need to know. How can they be stopped? And who needs to lead in doing that? We'll talk more about that with Didi Laugesen right after this.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Weeks before the Chinese Communist Party unleashed the COVID-19 pandemic, its representatives participated in Event 201, a tabletop exercise organized by, among others, Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Its stated purpose was to see how a coronavirus pandemic could be used to strengthen world government. A senior Biden administration official named Lance Pace happens to be a graduate of the Bloomberg School. She is also the author of 13 amendments that would transform the head of the World Health Organization into the global arbiter of what constitutes public health emergencies and how they will be addressed. Not our government, but CCP shill Tedros Ghebreyesus. Former Representative Michelle Bachmann says we need Republicans in Congress to conduct the equivalent of a general strike. No quorums, no legislation until Ms. Pace's appalling surrender of our national sovereignty is formally repudiated. Do it now. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm pleased to say we're joined once again by my colleague and friend Dede Laugesen, formidable freedom fighter here in the United States against, as we like to say here, all enemies, foreign and domestic. Dede, just to finish off the issue of the World Health Organization empowerment exercise at the expense of our sovereignty, I know Michelle Bachmann, former congresswoman and great patriot, has been engaging aggressively in trying to raise an alarm about this same topic. Give us your own thoughts, but also her recommendations for what we should try to do now to prevent this surrender of our sovereignty to, of all people, Tedros at the World Health Organization.
Yeah, so this dark of night move by the United States to submit these proposed amendments to the international health regulations, it circumvents a new pandemic response treaty. And in this way, we believe that it does not require Senate review or approval for these amendments. And that is a really serious danger because these amendments will just go into effect within about 6 months after, if a majority of the nation states approve. So what we're looking at is just a wholesale giveaway of our sovereignty to the WHO by the Biden administration. Americans must counter this. We must contact our elected officials, both Congress and Senate. And we will be making that available at our Committee on the Present Danger China Stop Vax Passports Task Force, stopvaxpassports.org. You'll be able to send a letter to your elected members of Congress and demand that they put a stop to these amendments going forward at the World Health Assembly May 22nd through the 28th. We must now act.
Check out stopvaxpassports.org. It'll be there momentarily. Dede, let me pivot to your other major life work at the moment, namely the persecution of Christians. Set the stage for us by talking about how widespread this phenomenon is around the world at this moment.
So, Frank, as you know, when we set up Save the Persecuted Christians as a coalition of human rights activists and others working in the space of Christian persecution, providing aid and reporting on, we came together to help elevate those stories and hold the persecutors accountable for their crimes against humanity. When we started in 2018, the Open Doors USA World Watch report, which comes out annually and reports on the 50 most dangerous countries for Christians, there were 215 million persecuted Christians in the world, heavily persecuted. This year, they came out and said that we are up to 360 million. That's more than every man, woman, and child in the United States. It's a 67% increase in the amount of heavily persecuted Christians. And nobody is talking about this. Everybody wants to talk about the other religious groups who are persecuted, but by far and away, in the world, Christians are the most persecuted.
Why is that, Dee Dee? Why is it that Christians have been singled out in so many places? It's most obvious, of course, in the Muslim world, but in communist China and North Korea, well, all over the planet, really, there is evidence of this problem. And as you say, that number relates just to those being heavily persecuted, not, you know, your garden variety mistreatment, which is bad enough. But this involves torture. This involves rape. This involves various kinds of enslavement, as well as outright murder, does it not? And why is this happening elsewhere around the world?
I think it goes to the nature of Christianity. Christians find our liberty in God and a loving God, a loving creator. And that is absolutely opposed to the agendas of most of these agnostic regimes, China and North Korea. But also it goes against Sharia supremacists. By far and away, the top 10 countries of the world, 8 of them are Islamic republics where Christians are mercilessly persecuted. And it is these controlling, dominant, oppressive belief systems that are opposed to the freedom that is granted through our beliefs as Christians.
Yeah. It also probably has something to do with just expropriating people's property, or as I say, gaining their enslavement and servitude as a result. But it does clearly have an ideological or religious impetus behind it, and we cannot ignore this. It's just outrageous. But in the closing couple of minutes we have, Dee Dee, I did want to pivot once more to a problem that is now manifesting itself increasingly. Tucker Carlson talked about it recently as a blight here in America as well, now unfolding before our eyes, namely this danger of the persecution of Christians inside the United States of America. Talk about the extent and implications of that, if you would.
Well, I've always said if we don't fight Christian persecution out there, we will soon see it on our doorstep, and we are. More and more in the United States, Christians are seen as the radicals, the extremists, the hate speech mongers. We saw this over the weekend as the abortion protesters circled around the Basilica of St. Patrick's in New York. The men are standing on the stairs praying a rosary, and you have this obscene woman dressed in just a onesie with a baby in her and swinging the stuff around. And it's just appalling that the men praying are the ones who are depicted by the Biden administration as the extremists, as the danger to the United States.
Because they oppose abortion, I take it, is the prime example. But are there other considerations as well?
Absolutely. So we have, we just saw in Boston last week, the Boston Supreme Court or Massachusetts Supreme Court had to overturn a decision by Boston to not fly a Christian flag from Hal Shurtleff at the Camp Constitution. They fly the CCP flag every year. They fly the rainbow flag, but they would not fly a Christian flag. Absolutely. And we're seeing this in so many different ways. We're seeing it with the purge of the military for military members who will not abide by the CRT or the gender fluidity. And they are being, Christians more and more are being marginalized, pushed out of the public square, censored and canceled across the board. And this is where we see eventually we'll see the crush come and that Christians will actually be harshly persecuted here and not just discriminated against.
Yeah. I would argue that what we're starting to see is threats of physical violence at a minimum, intimidation for sure. So it's moving inexorably in the direction you've been warning about, as you say, for some time, Dee Dee, and shame on us that we as a free people have not done more about what's happening to Christians around the world in these unimaginably large numbers just because they follow Jesus Christ. And it is coming home to roost here, and we must now stand up for our freedoms, religious and otherwise, and those of others who, of course, are practicing their faith with, the danger of some kind of persecution as well. But Christians most especially are in need of our support, and that's what Save the Persecuted Christians is all about. Dee Dee Laugesen, thanks for joining us. Next up, we're going to talk about the Disinformation Governance Board and its purveyor right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. There's a lot of talk at the moment about disinformation. The U.S. government has announced that it's got a new Disinformation Governance Board at the Department of Homeland Security, a law enforcement agency. This is very ominous, but in a way, even more ominous is the fact that this board and its responsibility for determining what is disinformation and who will be allowed to disseminate information of any kind, mis, dis, or mal, is a woman by the name of Nina Jankowicz. To talk about her background, to talk about what her charge is, and to talk about how this really fits into what I call, well, the Chinese call, but I refer to as the China model. It is their sort of digital gulag, is another way of describing it, that they are seeking to not only impose massively on their own people, but to export to others, including here in the United States. The man who I have turned to with some regularity to gain insights into what the Chinese Communist Party has demonstrated in the way of the black arts of propaganda and manipulation of populations, cultural and otherwise, is our next guest. His name is Lance Crayon. He knows whereof he speaks because he was for a time a senior editor for one of the leading propaganda arms of the Chinese Communist Party, Global Times. He worked both in Beijing and in Los Angeles for that outfit. And he has come forth with insights into what the Chinese are up to and who works with them, or at least is working towards the same ends of, I believe, destroying America, very much the goal of the Chinese Communist Party. Lance Crayon, welcome back to Securing America. It's great to have you with us, sir. So let's start with this whole idea of a board inside a law enforcement agency in the United States responsible for governance of disinformation. Does this sound a lot like the CCP's arrangements?
It sounds like a page ripped right out of the playbook. And let's call it what it is, Ministry of Truth. Okay, that's what they have in China.
Using the Orwellian term.
Sure, right? Thing. Yeah, exactly. That's what it is.
So it's a ministry of truth, meaning that it's truth as the regime construes it. Those who toe the party line, as the Chinese are fond of calling it, benefit, and those who deviate from the party line are punished. Which brings us to this woman, Nina Jankowicz, who will be charged with, apparently, the rewarding and the punishing with respect to disinformation. What has your research shown about her background that makes this a very dubious appointment?
Okay, I immediately had my suspicions when media came out and said there's not a lot that we know about her. She's kept a private life. So that's immediately, I threw up a red flag. I go, no way. That's impossible. So for the past, I'd say 5 days or so, I've cursory research, and then which later became a deep dive. First of all, her last name, she spells her name differently now. It's Jankowicz, W-I-T-Z. Okay, let's start there. Why was the name changed? Her father changed the name after he was a police officer, which he's failed to mention, in New Jersey in the late 70s. Why he changed the name, I've got some theories there. Once I have more information, I'll share that. But no comment on there. Her father was a Vietnam vet who died of Agent Orange, complications from Agent Orange in 2010. She has come out and said that her ancestors, grandparents, escaped the Warsaw Ghetto. Okay, that's a lie. Okay. Her grandparents on her father's side were born and raised in New Jersey. Her grandparents on her mother's side were actually well-to-do business people who arrived like on the Queen Mary. There was no, I mean, she's got a story about her father who was 10, shipped off to Siberia. Maybe he went through there as a 10-year-old, but they were actually quite successful business people in New Jersey very early on. And very, very comfortable life. Her parents, her ancestors, who supposedly that she's also intimated were Jewish. No, they're all Catholic. They're 100% Catholic. And this I've confirmed from her mother. Her mother, in 2004, this is kind of hard to find online, but wrote an essay about her entire genealogy for a Polish magazine. This is in 2004. I have it. Mapping it all out and their involvement in World War I, her ancestors fighting with the Austrian cavalry. Go down the list how they founded a Catholic church. Her grandparents were married in a Catholic church. It's all spelled out
so
by
Lance,
her mother.
This all raises questions about her veracity, needless to say, as well as why she would go to these lengths to sort of obscure her actual background. Tell us a little bit more about her political activities. She certainly was not off the web by any means. We have a video of her singing, among other things, some rather partisan renderings of popular music. Give us a little bit more about her present and recent past.
Well, I mean, she's working in Russia and in Ukraine, and as an assistant, really. Apparently, she's fluent in Russian, which if so, okay, fine. I've yet to see video of her speaking Russian, but I'm at the point now where anything that comes out of her mouth, I'm going to triple check, not double check. I don't care what it is. So I'm not exactly clear. This is, I mean, I can tell you what we've read and what we've been told about what she was doing in Russia or Ukraine and as an assistant or attaché, whatever. But I'm not exactly sure if that's true because I can't find any record of that. I'm sure she was there, but I mean, I'm talking, if we have videos of her singing in DC with her from 2015, as you pointed out, where's everything else? I mean, there's these huge holes. Okay. I'm sorry to answer your question. I can't confirm what she was doing and how she's qualified, remotely qualified, a 33-year-old to run, to be the head of what's information, what's disinformation. That's mind blowing. Right. It's like,
well, the public record that I've seen, and again, who knows about its veracity, is that she worked for the National Endowment for Democracy's democratic arm, the National Democratic Institute, in Ukraine, and I guess in Russia. And she was, at least in the profile that I saw, she was described as sort of a hardliner, and she was promoting democracy, and she was countering disinformation in these places. Does that not sound right to you?
When I see evidence of that, then sure. But I and I've read the same thing you've read. I know that's what I've heard.
But those are presumably the credentials that are giving rise to this idea that she'll be the gal who ought to determine for the U.S. government in a very much, you know, Communist Party style of diktat, what's agreeable, what's acceptable, what's kosher, if you will, and what's not. And Lance, just very quickly, to the extent that someone who has a history of disinformation herself, notably some of her partisan screeds about Hunter Biden's laptop, for example, or about the Russia hoax that, you know, portrayed Donald Trump as a dupe of Putin and collaborator, this would seem to be disqualifying for anybody in a position, set aside how deeply unacceptable is the position itself. Somebody with these credentials would seem to be, you know, exactly the wrong sort of person to be in the job, no?
And that's exactly China's, that's a China style right there. Don't acknowledge it. You know, she's not deleting these tweets that, where she acknowledged the Steele dossier and all that stuff or Biden's laptop. That would just add fuel to the fire. Just simply ignore it. Do not acknowledge when someone calls you out on your own contradictions, and just move forward.
Brazen it out.
Yes,
here's
just one more factoid that I find very, very amusing and very surprising. I just learned this yesterday. So she's married, and again, the narrative is, we don't know a lot about this couple. We don't know a lot about the husband. The husband is a head of development for a company called Palantir, a right-wing Republican organization, a tech company, security tech company.
Yeah, a defense contractor.
Yes.
Some renown.
Peter Thiel, the founder. That has been completely... I mean, that's all we know. We know his name, Michael Stein, and that's it.
And that's all we're going to know for today. You're going to tantalize us with a return visit to tell us more about him and how this bears on, you know, her credentials. But the larger point here is, this is a gal who should not be anywhere near a position of power, it seems to me. And I appreciate your sharing this evidence. Lance Crayon, thank you so much for joining us. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Walton right after this.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Weeks before the Chinese Communist Party unleashed the COVID-19 pandemic, its representatives participated in Event 201, a tabletop exercise organized by, among others, Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Its stated purpose was to see how a coronavirus pandemic could be used to strengthen world government. A senior Biden administration official named Lance Pace happens to be a graduate of the Bloomberg School. She is also the author of 13 amendments that would transform the head of the World Health Organization into the global arbiter of what constitutes public health emergencies and how they will be addressed. Not our government, but CCP shill Tedros Ghebreyesus. Former Representative Michelle Bachmann says we need Republicans in Congress to conduct the equivalent of a general strike. No quorums, no legislation until Ms. Pace's appalling surrender of our national sovereignty is formally repudiated. Do it now. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a delight to be able to say welcome to our next guest as well. He is Bill Walton. He is the star of the Bill Walton television podcast, a program that I admire greatly and have had a chance to be on occasion. And we're always delighted to do a home and home with him. He brings to this topic of our country and protecting it a wealth of experience on Wall Street, notably as the president and CEO of Allied Capital. He has also been active in conservative movement policy making as the past president of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm proud to be a member. He's a good friend as well, and always delighted to have him with us. Welcome back, Bill.
Thanks, Frank, as always.
A lot to talk about, my friend. Let's start with Shanghai, Bill. It's a major city of China, of course. It is the largest port in the world, I understand. And it has been in complete lockdown, basically, for the better part of 2 months now. And the consequences of that for us, as well as for the people most immediately involved, are quite significant. Walk us through what is going on in Shanghai at the moment and what we should take away from it.
Well, Shanghai right now is kind of a Rorschach block as to trying to figure out what the Chinese, in particular President Xi, is all about. I mean, they've locked Shanghai down with their zero COVID strategy, and it means 25 million people. As you point out, the largest port in the world. It's four times larger than the port of Los Angeles, and really the hub for the international economy. And he's not just locked down Shanghai. They're of the top 100 cities by population in China. I think about 75 of them are experiencing material lockdowns. And there's lots of worries now in Beijing that he's going to bring it into Beijing. And I say Rorschach because this is one hard to figure out. Xi got all kinds of international accolades because they claimed to stop COVID by locking down Wuhan 2 years ago. And a lot of us are deeply suspicious about whether that really worked or whether it was just his press. And now in this effort to keep COVID-19 from spreading, which we know is impossible, he's locked everything down and he's wrecked the economy. The economy has gone from 10-15% growth a couple of years ago to 6%, 7% last year. Estimates now this year, 3-4%, it may shrink for the first time since Deng took over from Mao and started bringing the Chinese economy into the modern world. What this means is that China's economic clout is really, as they diminish what's going on in Shanghai, it's hurting America. The if you look at some maps or look at some graphics of the number of container ships backed up in the Shanghai harbor, it's astonishing. And so global trade has shut down or has been dramatically reduced. And then with the other side of the continent, Eurasia, we've got the Russia sanctions in place, which is hurting Well, it's obviously hurting Russia, but it's also hurting the European economy and also the American economy. And so as you think about Xi's thoughts, does he, is this lockdown really about the virus, or is the lockdown about something else?
Yeah. And there is speculation, Bill, that one of the things that's going on is that there is a restive party faction in Shanghai, I believe led by Xi Jinping, the previous president or general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, and that, you know, punishing that potential block of adversaries in the run-up to this fall's sort of coronation that Xi is seeking for his third term might be a consideration in what he's doing to the people of Shanghai. It seems like a monstrous overkill if what you're really trying to do is punish a certain small block of party members.
They've got a Politburo meeting in the fall, and he wants a third term. He really wants it for life, but he's got to get reelected to the third term. And he's locked into this zero COVID strategy. He's also locked into his relationship with Vladimir Putin. And so he's got things that he's not in control of. And if you talk to people in China, the sophisticated private equity investment managers, the whole lot of them, you can't find a single one of them that believe that Xi knows what he's doing with the economy. The best quote is one of them says, "Unfortunately, I think his knowledge and his rationality is limited."
Well, and that's putting it very mildly, needless to say, and discreetly for purposes of being possibly sent off to the gulag. You want to be very careful what words you use about the guy who's running the place. Yeah, but the point is, Bill, that whether it's supply chains or whether it's what they're doing to their capital markets or what it's they're doing to their people, most especially, what we're witnessing is sort of the worst of totalitarian, tyrannical misrule. And its implications are not confined narrowly to the people of China. As you say, this major seaport is the hub of international commerce in many respects. And just a very quick word, we've got to take a break in about a minute, but how is that having an impact on, you know, shortages in this country of raw materials, products, food, and other things?
Well, if you think the supermarket shelves are growing bare now, just wait till next year. You know, on the Russia side of things, the fertilizer world, which they produce through the natural gas, and also they ship it off to Germany, which produces fertilizers, which help grow the crops. Those prices are off the charts now, and some farmers are even refusing to buy it. And we'll just have to see what kind of yields we get on the China side of it. As I mentioned, there's 75 other economies besides Shanghai, many of them major manufacturing entities, and they're all getting shut down. And the question you really got to ask is, Xi doesn't really care about people except as an abstraction. And he, you know, we've seen the Chinese kill tens of millions of people. And it's clear he doesn't really care about economic growth. He cares about power. And here's something ominous. They're now thinking after shutting down tech firms and...
Bill Walton, we have to ask you to hold that thought. We got to take a hard break here. We'll be right back with more with Bill Walton of The Bill Walton Show. On the other side of this short break, it's a thought that I don't want to truncate. We're going to come right back to all of it right after this. We're back, and we're joined once again, I'm pleased to say, by Bill Walton. He's a regular here at Securing America, and we tap his brains with gusto, particularly on matters involving finance and economics. And Bill, you were just making a point about how international businesses in Shanghai or working with those in Shanghai are being impacted. Finish that thought, if you would.
Well, we have Shanghai, of course, which is the distribution point for all the goods that come out of China and distributed into China. But it's also many of the other major cities, and they're all being shut down with the zero COVID policy.
Yeah, by some estimates, 400 million people being impacted. It's unbelievable. Yeah. And possibly Beijing as well. Well, Bill, one of the things that's so striking about this, and we had a fascinating webinar yesterday that our Committee on the Present Danger China, of course, of which you are a member, sponsored with our colleague Reggie Littlejohn's Women's Rights Without Frontiers. We entitled it The Digital Gulag. And basically what that did was sort of lay out how, under the cover of this COVID-19 pandemic, which came out of, as you said earlier, Wuhan, China, we've seen a succession of steps taken, including this zero COVID policy and the lockdowns and the mask mandates and the vaccines, even if they haven't been properly tested, being forcefully imposed upon people. And China has not only created that China model at home, but it has aggressively sought to have it exported elsewhere, including here in the United States. Talk a little bit about what a stark departure that has been from past practice and how it's really changing not just public health approaches in this country and our response to this virus, most especially, of course, but actually, you know, our country, our polity, our society.
Well, it seems pretty clear that the lockdowns did not work. Steve Moore and Phil Kirpin and Casey, I can't remember his last name, from University of Chicago, just put out a study analyzing how the 50 states fared, and we had a workshop or a test case here where you get all 50 states, different policies with regard to mask mandates, lockdowns, business closures, et cetera, and the jury's in. After 2 years, the states that did not lock down fared much better on matters of health, their economy, and economic or in educational well-being. And the states that locked down the most, you know, we can think of them, Illinois and New York among them, New Jersey, their economy hasn't recovered. Their health measures were not any better. In fact, some cases worse. And so the idea now that Xi is still promoting lockdowns, there's something else here, Frank. You and I both know that. I mean, they're using these pandemics, these emergency measures, basically to get control of people. And one of the ways they're doing it is trotting out these ideas of vaccine mandates. Now, that seems to have faded temporarily here in the United States, but I think it's still in the playbook.
And oh, absolutely. And worse, Bill, as we talked about in the webinar yesterday, the mechanisms by which it can be imposed and enforced, notably these vaccine passports, is going ahead as though nothing else had changed.
The technologies are very different. This is not your grandfather's passport that he used to go to France and, you know, after World War II. These are digital. And which means that they not only have your vaccine records, but they've got most of you, they can theoretically have most of your other medical records. Financial records are not far behind, voting records, whatever. I mean, there's a way to get an entire dossier on everybody who has one of these. Now,
right. And this isn't, yeah, this isn't an abstract or hypothetical proposition. Talk about China.
It's already happening. Social credit in China, it is happening. Now, one can say the Chinese don't have a long history of being freedom fighters. It's a much different culture. Nevertheless, we've also seen here in the United States where people willingly put on their obedience masks to signal their virtue with regard to the virus. It can happen here.
Well, arguably it has happened here to some extent, and maybe there's been some relaxation of it, but it's still, you know, sort of in place. And as our webinar pointed out, some 30 U.S. states, including a number run by Republicans, have actually adopted this vaccine passport called perhaps digital health cards or medical cards or something else. But nonetheless, and Bill, this is really the critical point about this sort of digital gulag idea, is if you wind up having migrated onto that card, not just your, as you say, health records and financial records, but also just about everything else about you, who you've interacted with, what you have said in your social media posts, where you're employed, how much you earn, maybe even you get your currency, you know, instituted there as well in a sort of programmable form that can be used again to manipulate or control you. This is chilling stuff, and it is coming here, is it not?
Well, we need to raise the alarm bells because it's already here. It's not been deployed as aggressively as we fear it could be deployed. But, you know, we're seeing things like the Minister of Truth or the Disinformation Bureau or whatever we're going to call it.
And governance board. I mean, that's the operative word as far as I'm concerned.
And, you know, so we need to make this an issue in the elections. We need to have people understand that these are not just people saying and doing stupid things and imposing regulations that hurt the economy and our freedoms, but they also have bigger things in mind, which is controlling what we think and who we talk to. And social credit, if you don't know about it, you ought to learn about it, because it means you get bonus points for doing what the government wants you to do. And you get demerits for doing what they don't. And if you get enough demerits, you can't travel. You can't leave your house. You can't shop. All those sorts of things.
You may lose your job. Your children can't be educated, and on and on. Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is such a really powerful call for action, not just greater awareness, but action. Absolutely. And be checking with your elected representatives or would-be ones in the course of this election campaign. Bill, thanks for joining us. Thanks to the rest of you for doing the same. Well, we hope you'll do so again tomorrow. Until then, I hope you'll go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.